Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Stephanie, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop. And it has a long title, Going the Distance, Thriving and Surviving with Chronic Myelogenous Leukemia, or CML. And actually, today's program is actually focusing on sharing responsibility for your care. And we have, today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And it really is because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. We have on the call today over 521 participants from all over the United States, from all different parts of the country. And we have international participants from Canada, China, Portugal, Venezuela, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world. And it's a credit to you that you're spending the next hour with us. I would like to turn your attention to all the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials is information about our speakers and the topics they're going to be covering, and there also is information about all of our different collaborating organizations, and you also all received a toolkit of information as well, some additional information as well, and all of this is as resources for all of you. And there is an evaluation form, and I would ask you to all take a moment at the end of today's program and complete that form, because when you think about it, who but each of you can, of course, tell us the topics, the programs you'd like us to offer going forward. And, you know, we are at a point in the year, in 2012, and we are planning many new programs, so your thoughts and recommendations could not be more timely to us as we're planning other programs. Now, today's program is made possible by a charitable contribution from Bristol-Myers Squibb, and I want to thank them for supporting not only today's program, but this entire series. Now, I want to begin by introducing our first speaker, and our first speaker is Dr. Michael Morrow. Dr. Morrow is a frequent presenter on our programs, and he's Associate Professor, Center for Hematologic Malignancies, Knight Cancer Institute at Oregon Health and Science University, and he's going to address an overview of current treatments for CML, new treatment approaches and clinical trials, and the important role of adherence in the management of CML. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Morrow.
Well, thank you, Carolyn, and thank you all for joining us today. I'd say this morning where I am, but it could be this afternoon or this evening or many different times a day, so thank you all. In just a short bit of time, I'm tasked with giving an overview of the current treatments for CML, clinical trials, and novel approaches, and talk a little bit about the adherence and compliance to therapy. And I love the title of this series, Going the Distance, because I often refer to CML treatment as my mentor, Brian Druker, and I both refer to it as that this is a marathon, it's not a sprint. Being a runner myself, I think I can strike a lot of chords with people on that. And we know that this is a dramatically different disease than it was a decade or more ago. And I'm going to start with a summary, actually, and work my way backwards. I think we're glad to say, and that we've all worked hard over many years to say, that CML is now overwhelmingly a condition that people live with. Long-term remissions are really the norm, and indefinite therapy is something that is under the microscope, and we're hopeful that someday that may not be necessary, but at least for now we have an exquisitely treatable disease that does require ongoing therapy. And so some of the topics we'll cover today are extremely important, that being making sure that therapy is a good fit, that side effects are managed, that people are comfortable on therapy, and that they can go the distance. There are a family of therapies available. Imatinib, which I'll talk about first, was developed and has really set the stage. Nilotinib, dasatinib, our second approved or second generation compounds which have been approved, have improved our ability to treat when Gleevec was not effective or was intolerable, and clearly now have become indicated as our first treatment options for people with newly diagnosed CML. We have other drugs in the pipeline, which I'll allude to as well, particularly a drug called ponatinib, which shows great promise. So we have a third generation of drugs, and we have many, we have a family of therapies, and we have covered essentially all the chinks in the armor. We really have the ability to optimize therapy for best response and side effects, and that's an important part of this topic today. have to think about this potential of success without treatment, but really focus on here and now success on treatment. And how do we, A, optimize remissions, B, equally as important, make sure someone's doing well and feeling well on treatment, and C, how do we frame the future? So let's go backwards in time now to our first studies with Gleevec or amantadine. Now, Gleevec was first in its class, a drug, a small molecule oral drug, which was designed to treat the specific abnormality in CML, the B-cerebral protein or the B-cerebral kinase, which was a product of the Philadelphia chromosome, the genetic hallmark of CML. We learned many lessons from our first trials comparing that new drug at that time, STI-571 or Gleevec, compared to our previous treatment, which was interferon. We really learned that, A, remissions were dramatically different on that drug. They were rapid, they occurred in the most patients, and that the drug was very well tolerated. We learned that early response was important. We have essentially mileposts that patients should pass in order to be considered performing best, or the drug performing best, that is, patients are doing the best they can, and the drug has to perform the best that it can. We know that risk of losing response or progressing in CML is an early phenomenon, not a chronic threat, and actually not something that increases over time, which was extremely good news. We know that we can profile the disease and when it presents by some characteristics, the things that make up a prognostic model called the SOCAL score, and again, some information about how the CML might behave and guide our treatments. But most of our treatments have been fairly universal, that chronic phase CML is treated in a standard fashion, and we don't tailor the drug necessarily based on the disease profile, but more the patient, and that's an important statement. Now, Gleevec or amantadine was very good, and with 8 or 9 years reported follow-up, now coming on 10 years and beyond, we see that the majority of patients treated will do well, but there are a proportion of patients who don't. There are about probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 to 40% of individuals who either don't respond quick enough or don't respond and then unfortunately lose response. There are some who don't tolerate the drug well and really it's intolerable for them. And for this reason, we have this gap, which has nicely been met by the availability of dasatinib and nilotinib as our approved medications to use after amantadine. And there were trials, which are now several years old, which showed a high degree of response and excellent tolerability, the majority of patients regaining remission, cytogenetic and of course hematologic response, and many of those patients have done well over the long term. We still do better when we treat most successfully with our initial therapy. So obviously using Gleevec first is an absolutely fine plan, but as you might imagine, we move quickly towards trials looking at using dasatinib and nilotinib as our first treatment. And those trials were key trials called the NSND and decision trials. And they really showed us the way that new diagnosis patients really might be best served by using a second-generation drug at diagnosis. They proved that both dasatinib and nilotinib improved cytogenetic responses, molecular responses, were very well tolerated with essentially some new unique side effects with each drug, some reduction in typical Gleevec-related side effects, but overall nothing that was thought to be an imbalance or not worth the marked improvement in response and protection against progression, that is, preventing people from having a loss of response or a loss of chronic phase, which is essential in CML treatment because we really want to, A, treat well early, but of course, B, we want to prevent people from losing their chronic phase or getting into a more advanced phase, especially early. We had many other trials in the last decade which have answered some more subtle questions about what about higher doses of Gleevec, what about combinations with Gleevec, including drugs we used previously like interferon, and those strategies are worthy in certain circumstances. I particularly mentioned that interferon is a drug which is a challenge to take sometimes, but may still be useful in combination with Gleevec. And it continues in trials being used now in combination with our newer drugs, and so I wouldn't consider a standard approach now, but it's still a useful drug and bears some attention. The real progress has been in that we have now multiple options to treat people with. And in thinking about finding the right therapy for the right patient, we're able to optimize both tolerability and response. Let's talk about response just a little bit more. We are, as you might imagine, becoming more and more stringent with regards to our expectations. And some more recent data just in the last few months presented at our research meetings, the ASH meetings, we've seen that we are getting better at showing that people have ample response and are doing well and can hold with their current therapy, or do they need to switch? And a lot of data has now been generated around looking at 3 months at a simple blood test, a molecular test at 3 months, and looking at the level of reduction of BCR-ABL, the transcript level, and based on that value, either deciding to hold because the hand is good and things are going well and to continue on treatment, or potentially that there's early evidence that this might not be the right therapy and that relapse or loss of response may be more likely, and we should change therapy. And with three different options to treat, and potentially a fourth or fifth option on the horizon, I think we can, again, earlier and more efficiently and more succinctly define who's doing fine and who doesn't need a change in therapy or who may need a change in therapy. Historically, early response in CML has meant better odds of long-term success. Cytogenetic response early at 6 or 12 months, molecular response at 12 or 18 months has predicted for best chances of long-term molecular remission and long-term stable response. We do have our expectations and our minimums. We do expect at 3 months now blood response and likely a 10% reduction. A reduction in BCR-ABL transcripts down to 10%, with generally people starting at 100% on an international scale, so a one log reduction. By 6 months, we expect generally a major cytogenetic response and further reduction in transcripts. At a year, we're expecting a cytogenetic complete remission. And at 18 months, we're expecting a molecular response that shows a 3-log reduction. That is a remission 10 times deeper than that of a complete cytogenetic remission. And those have been holding fairly firm. There's a new response threshold on the horizon called a complete molecular remission, which is a bit of a challenge because complete is a word that means entire or implies absence of the leukemia, and that's really not what we're dealing with, but more the good news that we've pushed the disease down below the level of detection in most of our laboratories. But we need to take that response milepost in context and understand that it's something that's achievable in a fraction of patients. It may be intermittent. Some people may have it at times, and that's fine. And we have to define a little bit better what the implications are, what the gain is of having a complete molecular remission, and certainly what the necessity is. We know now that patients who have a major molecular remission, that is a 3-log reduction, and who hold that and have no sign of any increase in their leukemia burden, do just fine. So a bit of caution is advised with regards to our enthusiasm for pursuing that. That being said, what is the future? And just in the last few minutes, I'd like to share some of our research, and that is, can we stop therapy at some point? Can patients have a remission that is high enough quality and they've been treated enough where they could stop therapy? Now, this is not something we recommend outside of a clinical trial. Please hear me clearly on this. The patients need to stay on therapy. But we have clinical trials aimed at looking at patients who appear to be in a certain category of response, perhaps this complete molecular remission as I described, or even good quality remissions, which may not be classified as complete, who may interrupt therapy on clinical trials and help us better understand who, how, and when, and with what implications. So just be aware that is happening, and certainly don't think that that's our standard, but don't hesitate to ask, and we will continue to work towards what we call a path to cure in this disease. The last thing to close with is that we do sometimes run into multiple blocks in CML where we see resistance or intolerance to multiple medications, and there's a very promising drug on the horizon called ponatinib. This drug in phase 1 and phase 2 trials has shown, as an oral once-a-day drug, the ability to treat patients who have had inadequate response or loss of response on multiple therapies. We've seen it highly effectively treat patients who have a selective resistance related to a mutation called a T315I. And this drug is moving quickly through final trial data, mileposts, and regulatory processes, and should be hopefully available within the next 6 to 12 months. So I'm very encouraged about that. There's another drug, bosutinib, which has been studied quite extensively, which may be approved as yet another in our second-generation class of compounds to be a partner with nilotinib and dasatinib. I'm encouraged about that as well. Again, all of this is contingent upon the importance of adherence and compliance to therapy. And as a physician, I think I'd just like to close by saying that one of the most important things is what happens when the exam room door closes, and hopefully there's a few minutes of open dialogue between patients. And, you know, a similar scenario sets up when someone sits down at the kitchen table and is talking about their day, their medications, their life with their caregiver, their family, someone who's listening. And for all the patients and caregivers out there, the most important thing is the dialogue that we manage this marathon. It's not a sprint of CML therapy, this journey, which requires attention to detail, open dialogue about side effects, asking questions of your physician about side effects, how to manage them, not being satisfied with having side effects which impair your quality of life to a degree where it makes you think about wanting to stop therapy. In my clinic, if someone's, I ask them directly, and if they say, I've been thinking about stopping therapy, that's a big sign to me that something's wrong. We haven't been able to manage side effects well enough. And the good news is that in 2012 and beyond, we'll have multiple medications for CML. We have a highly treatable disease, and that we should be able to work through for most people to a better quality of life, a good point where therapy is tolerable, response is good or optimal, and life can go on. I'm going to close because I want to give some time for my colleagues, and thank you for your attention.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Morrow. This was an extraordinary presentation. It was a marathon presentation. You covered a great deal, very comprehensive and informative, and also just your closing with the importance of the dialogue and the dialogue amongst the team members and the dialogue between the person with CML, their family, and the physician is so important as well. So thank you so much. I know there will be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Guadalupe Palos. Dr. Palos is, and we're talking about this being a multidisciplinary team of presenters, and she herself represents a number of different disciplines. She's both a nurse, social worker, and a doctor of public health. She's clinical research manager at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center, Division of Medical Affairs, Department of Cancer Survivorship. Dr. Palos is going to address barriers to taking your pills, practical tips to overcome these barriers, and communicating with your healthcare team, including your pharmacist. I now turn the program over to Dr. Palos.
Good afternoon, and thank you, Carolyn, for the opportunity to be involved in the discussion of medication adherence. Particularly, as Dr. Morrow explained, medications which are used to manage a chronic condition such as CML. The challenge for a patient or survivor is to learn to manage this condition on a day-to-day basis and continue to maintain a good quality of life. So, and one thing to remember, as the number of cancer survivors continue to increase, the topic of a patient or a survivor's adherence to their medication schedule is a topic that's going to continue and increase in its importance. Well, and it's particularly important to all of us participating in this call today. Why? Because, again, a major challenge for each of us is how to follow a medication plan when there are so many complex factors that influence our decisions to follow medication regimens. For example, such factors such as our health beliefs and practices may motivate us to follow the plan as carefully as possible. Yet other factors such as concerns for potential side effects or negative perceptions about the side effects may also keep us from following the plans. And not all the factors that contribute to non-adherence can be easily understood. Let me share an experience with you with clinical studies that I was involved in to evaluate the effectiveness and side effects of pain medication. In these studies, every patient that was eligible for the study had to have a moderate level of pain and would be receiving pain medications soon or were on them already. My assumption was because these patients were experiencing pain, of course they would take their pain meds as prescribed at the right time and at the right dose, and that there would be no skip doses. To my surprise, that assumption was inaccurate. Even patients who experienced pain did not always adhere to their pain plan. The reasons varied, and the majority of these factors were reasonable. Some patients said they feared taking too many medications and didn't want to add another's. Others were fearful of the side effects or the possible interactions with other medicines they were on. And others reported, well, I was feeling better and I didn't have pain, so why take the medications? This brief example demonstrates the complexity related to identifying and understanding the factors that influence medication behavior. I also learned a valuable lesson. I learned that taking the time to educate the patients, the caregivers, and their families at the beginning of a new medication plan would help minimize the risk of patients not following their medication regimen. And that was a very easy, proactive approach. The issue of taking meds on schedule becomes even more critical when managing medication regimens over a long period of time, say for the rest of your life. In addition to those medications that you're taking, there's also prescribed medications that patients may take, such as medications to manage the hypertension, the diabetes, arthritis, to name a few of those conditions. However, as demonstrated in my story, we recognize the struggle patients, their caregivers, or family members have in keeping track of all the details related to such a complex schedule. So a reasonable question to ask is, how can we, as patients, caregivers, or providers, support patients in achieving optimal adherence when being prescribed medications on a short-term or a long-term basis? I will briefly address this question in my discussion, and I will also recommend some simple strategies that patients and caregivers can use to be proactive by asking specific questions of their healthcare team about their medications and how the family and providers can support the patient in meeting the scheduled time. Research indicates that there are multiple complex factors that contribute. Now, there are so many. Given our limited time, I'm not going to be able to address each type, but I'll focus on a few major ones. A major barrier was something that Dr. Morrow referred to, the concern about the side effects. In general, medications will cause side effects, but the good news is that they will vary in severity and type, and there are methods to control those side effects. For example, constipation is often associated with pain medication, and so many patients choose not to take their medication. They'll rather deal with the pain than the constipation. So a strategy recommended to manage that side effect is to receive education and information about a bowel plan to follow as someone begins the medication plan. That's also a proactive strategy for you as the patient or you as the caregiver to ask about side effects before they occur. Another issue is communication between providers and patients and their families, or should I say maybe a breakdown in communications. Patients are often reluctant to take a provider's time to ask about side effects, doses, or interactions with other medications they may be taking. They may believe the provider's too busy to answer those types of questions, and often we as providers may assume the patients and caregivers know about these issues. The outcome is patients do not receive adequate education about the side effects, how to address them, or receive information about how to take the medications. For example, do I take them before or after my meals? Patient-related factors are also factors that contribute to non-adherence, and some of these are personal characteristics such as age, the ability to read the instructions or even see the instruction, and then someone's mental status or cognitive status would also contribute to that. In our older patients, both patients and caregivers may have concerns about side effects or interactions which can occur when taking the different types of medication. We know this population is particularly vulnerable to side effects from the interactions. In fact, in some cases, some of these meds may increase the risk for more severe side effects in our older populations. So it is important to have that dialogue with your provider and to be able to ask questions about side effects that may potentially occur before they occur. Then there are also financial barriers, such as having a copayment tied to each medication. And by the way, if that is a problem, I'd like to remind you that Cancer Care provides services in this area, so you may wish to contact them after the call. Another significant barrier contributing to non-adherence is related to psychosocial barriers. Examples of those barriers include a patient's personal beliefs towards health, wellness, and illness, the presence or absence of a social support network to help the patient, or even having a sense of, I can't control this condition, so why do I even manage? And Mr. Dickens, our colleague on this call, will describe the psychosocial services provided by Cancer Care. And a crucial area often overlooked by provider, but most important to patients and family members, are cultural or religious beliefs, practices, and traditions that may influence one's decision to take medications as scheduled or not at all. So one proactive approach a patient or family member can take is to inform the provider if these types of factors will influence the medication plan. Now take a moment and ask yourself, have you encountered these challenges? And if so, how did you deal with them? Perhaps those of you who have successfully dealt with these barriers may wish to share your tips with the audience during our Q&A period. Your information may help others in the call. So there's no doubt that there are barriers to taking medications, and they can range from a simple obstacle such as I can't take the lid off the prescription bottle to a more complex one as to how do I organize and maintain a schedule for taking over 4 or 8 or even 10 pills a day. So many of our listeners may be thinking by now, okay, now we know about the barriers, but tell us how to deal with them so we can get back on track for taking meds as scheduled. Well, I'll share some tips on how to manage these barriers. First tip, remember it is truly important to follow the schedule of the dose and correct medication as prescribed. There are many different ways to keep track of the schedule. For example, you can set alarms on electronic devices, your watch, your smartphone, your computer, or your iPad. And if you're not a tech type and prefer written aids, make a poster of your meds. Color code them to indicate purpose. Note the time and dose and how to take the medication. Is it by mouth and swallow, by mouth and dissolve? Use the same color code on the lids of the prescription containers so you'll have consistency on the colors and how to take the medications. There are also different ways to organize medications. For example, some people prefer to use pill containers by the day and others by the week. The methods will depend on your preferences and your needs and often on your work setting. So some of you may be thinking, that seems like quite a bit of work. And yes, it may be up front, but it will minimize the risk of missed doses, incorrect meds being taken, or pills not being available when needed. So let's continue to the second tip. Tip two is to keep a log of your medication with you at all times. For example, keeping an index card in your purse or wallet is a good, easy way to keep the information with you. On that index card, write down the names and contact information of the physicians prescribing the medication, the pharmacy where the medications are obtained, and include emergency information for each provider and pharmacist. Remember, be creative in dealing with these types of obstacles. And again, a major strategy is to maintain open and ongoing communication with your pharmacist. It may be your pharmacist at the facility or the pharmacist where in your community where you may be picking up some of your medications. Both pharmacists are valuable sources of information and education. A last tip to remember is the importance of planning ahead of time whenever travel is scheduled, and our speaker, Dr. Thompson, will address those issues and strategies. So in the last few moments, just remember, you can also ask your providers to do some of the following. Ask them to tailor their instructions on your learning preferences. For example, do you prefer written or verbal instructions? Ask them if there's any patient education counseling to help you and your family understand the schedule and the doses and other important details about the medication. You can consider asking your physician or their office staff if they have alerts or reminder systems for prescription refills. And then there's also innovative strategies that are being created, such as the use of a computer-assisted patient monitoring or counseling programs. Finally, remind yourself to maintain a balance. Plan ahead and prioritize depending on your situation and medications. My colleagues and I look forward to hearing from you and the suggestions you may have for caregivers and those and patients for how those medications can be taken. Thank you for allowing me to share these thoughts with you.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Talos. It's just an extraordinary presentation, wonderful as always, and with great tips, but also that we will, during the Q&A, invite people to both ask questions, but also if you have a tip that you'd like to share that's really worked for you, we're interested as well, as Dr. Talos has said, to hear anything that's really you'd like to recommend to everybody to do as well. That's terrific. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Lisa Thompson. Dr. Thompson is a pharmacist, and we're really fortunate to have her on the call. I have to say that we have searched far and wide to find pharmacists for our teleconferences, and we're delighted to have Dr. Thompson with us today. And she's assistant professor, Department of Clinical Pharmacy, University of Colorado Skagg School of Pharmacy and Pharmaceutical Sciences. Now, Dr. Thompson is going to address planning ahead, lead time in refilling prescriptions, vacations, holidays, travel, including through different time zones and weekends. It's always a big issue. And tips for low vision. It's my pleasure to turn this program over to Dr. Thompson.
Hi, thank you, and good afternoon to everyone. I'll be speaking with you today about how to cope with some of these really common events that may make it hard to take your medicine. Planning ahead is very important, like Dr. Lupe mentioned, whenever you're refilling your medicine. Many pharmacies don't routinely keep these medicines, especially those used for cancer or for CML, in stock in their pharmacy, so they may need a few days' notice in order to get those ordered and to have them in order to fill your prescription. depending on, you know, if it's over the weekend or not, it can take up to 4 or 5 days sometimes to get the medicine in once they've placed the order. So it's really best to give your pharmacy about a 1 week notice about filling your medication. So when you start to notice you're getting a little low, go ahead and let the pharmacy know, I'll need to pick this up in a week, and they can go ahead and get the ball rolling on their end and get that process started so you're not delayed. Related to that, if you find that you're out of refill or need a new prescription from your doctor, be sure to also give them a few days' notice. This is in case your doctor may be out of town or if he or she needs to order any lab tests before refilling your medicine. They have time to do that and to get the process started on those things as well. I also want to talk ahead a little bit about planning for emergency situations. I grew up in the Southeast, so we always worried about tornadoes and everything, and, you know, making sure you have your medicine with you in case of an emergency situation where you might not be able to get home. It's always helpful to keep a few extra pills in a label bottle in your office at work, for example, if you are required to stay over there or if you're not able to get home due to weather or other concerns. Also, with almost being summertime here in the States, many people are starting to plan their vacations and other travel plans for the summer and the fall. And when planning for your trip, also be sure to plan ahead for your medicine. It's important to be sure you have more than enough medicine to last, not just for the duration of your trip, but for a few days up to a week beyond when you plan to be back, in case your return may be delayed due to weather or due to other unforeseen circumstances. If you don't have enough currently and it's too early for a refill, let your pharmacist know the reason you're asking for more medicine early. Many insurance companies will do what's called a vacation override, is what the pharmacist might call it, where they call in and explain the situation, that you'll be out of town when you should normally get it filled and will need more medicine, and they're able to do that for you. If you're traveling for a long period of time, like people that travel seasonally or plan to be gone for multiple months, it's important to identify a pharmacy in the new location before you leave for your trip. Pharmacies can transfer prescriptions, including those used to treat cancer, over the phone, but they do need, again, at least a week's notice. So identify the new pharmacy and talk to them about the situation and see if they're able to do that for you. When traveling for the actual trip, I have a few tips as well to make sure your medicine is safe and in the best condition when you get there. If you're traveling by car, it's really important to keep your medicine at the right room temperature. If you leave your medicine in the car, in the glove compartment, and the car heats up, the medicine can actually melt. Certain capsules are gel-based, and they'll melt and heat and all clump together, and so that can really affect your ability to take your medicine if it's all in one clump in the bottle. I usually suggest that keep your medicine in a purse or another bag that you'll have with you at all times. Even if you think you're just running in for a few minutes, it might last longer, so it's always a good idea to keep that with you in that room temperature environment. If you're traveling someplace where there's extreme heat and there's not any air conditioning available, such as a camping trip, it's important to plan ahead for that. There are certain coolers that are made that are designed to keep medicines at the right room temperature, and so having one of those can really help keep your medicine safe when you're traveling. If you're traveling by air, be sure to keep your medicine with you in your carry-on bag. Since checked baggage, again, is exposed to really hot and cold temperature changes during flights, this can also damage your medicine. Even if it looks normal, it might be damaged because it was too cold and it changed the structure of the actual medicine. Checked baggage is also more likely to be lost, or if your flight gets delayed on the runway for a long time, you might not be able to access it. So it's really important to keep your medicine with you in your carry-on bag and not to have that bag checked. If you use a pill organizer at home, which I think is a great way to help remember to take medicines on time and on the right schedule, it's important to remember that when you're traveling, it needs to be in the original bottle that you got from the pharmacy. This is because the label on that bottle has a lot of really important information, who the doctor is, that the medicine is for you, and it also identifies what the medicine is, so it's not just a unmarked pill that they would have to go and identify then. This is especially important when you're traveling internationally. If you're leaving the country, it's also a good idea to have a copy of your prescription with you and that the prescription is written not using the brand name but using the generic name, the one that ends in NIB for most of these medicines, since brand names are different in different countries. Also, depending on the country you're going to, it may also be helpful to have a note from your doctor, you know, just kind of reinforcing the information on the prescription that you're prescribed this medicine, you need to take it every day, and you need to have it with you at all times. And this can may be helpful if you're going through customs in another country. It's also very important when you're traveling internationally to have that extra supply of medicine with you, since not all medicines are available in all countries, and different countries have different standards for their medicine. It's important that you have a supply that you got here in the United States or in your home country for your trip. And as you guys know very well, it's important to take your medicine at a similar time each day, relatively close together. When you're traveling across multiple time zones, especially when leaving the country, this can make taking your medicine, you know, every 12 hours or every 24 hours much more difficult. If you're planning a trip that crosses over more than one time zone, be sure to talk to your doctor or your pharmacist first about how to time your medicine during your trip. Depending on how far you're traveling and for how long you'll be gone, they can give you very specific recommendations for what time to take your medicine on the new schedule. Another issue that comes up a lot, especially in the summer, I think, is changes in routine. So if it's the weekend or if you're going on vacation and doing other different things, you're out of your routine. And I know with me, when I take medicine, it's triggered by something like, oh, I got home from work, it's time to take my medicine, or I got up and walked the dog, and now it's time to take my medicine. So any change in my routine is very likely to throw me off, and I'm sure some of you may have the same struggle as well. Over the weekend or when you're on vacation, it may be helpful to set an alarm to go off at the time you should take your dose, just to give you that reminder that, you know, it is, you know, 6 p.m. It's the time I normally take my medicine, so that reminds me that I need to do it since I'm not reminded by my routine. Taking medicines can also be somewhat challenging if you have low vision or if you have trouble seeing things. I know the writing on prescription labels can be pretty small, and it's hard to identify medicines just by looking at the pill other than by color and sometimes shape. So there are a few things that you or, you know, your family members or other caregivers can do to help. When you're picking up medicine at the pharmacy, ask them to open the bag and, you know, show you your medicines and talk about which pill is in each bottle. If you have a Sharpie or a marker with you, you can write on the lid or on the side of the bottle, you know, something to remind you that this is this drug and that I need to take it this many times a day, and something that is large enough for you to read. Some pharmacies also have the ability to make larger print labels if you let them know that you need that, or you can ask them also to put things in different shaped bottles to help you remember which medicine is which one. Pill organizers can also be a great help here. Especially if you have someone that's able to help you put things in the organizer to get everything in the right slot. Some pharmacies will also do this, especially some independent pharmacies are much more likely to do this than some of the bigger chains. So it's definitely worth asking to see if they can help you by providing that service. Also, if you are having trouble with seeing and you're worried about taking your medicine because of that, talk to your doctor about it. They can recommend you to see an occupational therapist or some other services in your area that can have some really useful tips. And then before I close, I just want to reiterate again the importance of Dr. Lupe's suggestion to keep an up-to-date list of all the medicines that you take, to keep a copy with you, another copy in your home in case you lose the one you had with you in your wallet, and also to make sure your family members know where to find that list and that you take it with you every time you see a healthcare provider. Even if it's not your regular doctor or pharmacist, if you're going to the dentist, a lot of other healthcare providers, including dentists and eye doctors and things, do also need to know about your other medicines. So thanks so much, and I look forward to your questions.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Thompson. That was really a wonderful presentation and really covering a lot of the issues that people confront in dealing with their filling their prescriptions and how to deal with the pharmacy, and just you answered a lot of really great questions for everyone and particularly about the time zones, and just really terrific. So I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, and thank you so much, and we look forward to your presentations on our programs in the future as well. Our next speaker is Richard Dickens. Mr. Dickens is Clinical Supervisor, Blood Cancers Program Coordinator, Mind-Body Project Coordinator at Cancer Care, and he will address the free psychosocial services offered by Cancer Care. I now turn the program over to Mr. Dickens.
Thank you, Carolyn. I'd like to tell you all about Cancer Care's services and how they can help. For CML patients as well as family members, there are numerous issues which will impact your lives, such as concerns about insurance, workplace issues, or treatment side effects, and possible impact of a chronic disease on normal activities of daily living. These and other questions are common concerns and can create anxiety and uncertainty. At some point, the whole process will become familiar to you, and you will develop what is often called a new normal. That is why building relationships with your healthcare team are so important. For many, it is helpful to think of this relationship as a partnership or collaboration. Your oncology team are experts in your cancer and treatment, but you are the expert of your body and your life. And here are some tips to guide you. Number one, do your research. The internet is a good place to start, but there are many helpful organizations such as Cancer Care that can guide you through this process. Becoming a knowledgeable consumer will go a long way toward giving you a sense of control and making you an active member in your treatment decisions. Number two, take your time. Sometimes saying, I need a day to think about this, can provide an opportunity to catch your breath and get valuable feedback from loved ones and other respected resources. And three, speak up. Don't be afraid to bring up any topic of concern to your healthcare team. Remember, your doctor and oncology team can't treat a problem if you don't make them aware of it. And Dr. Morrow, Dr. Thompson, and Dr. Palos have all stated this. It's very important. Accepting that changes are normal during treatment can go a long way toward nurturing your body and spirit. Cancer Care has been around for almost 70 years. Among our services, we provide information on other resources and strategies for finding help within your community. We provide some financial assistance, counseling interventions with master's degree oncology social workers, and run regional face-to-face groups as well as national telephone and online support groups for patients and loved ones. These services can provide emotional support, coping strategies, and validation that you're not alone in what you feel. And we archive these Connect workshops on podcasts on our webpage so people can access them easily and as often as needed. For many people, counseling, support, groups, education, and resources go a long way in helping to confront the different challenges of cancer. And daunting as they are, with help, they are never impossible. I wish you all the best.
Thank you very much, Rick, and for that very eloquent description of the Cancer Care Services and that we are here to help everyone on the call. Now, I want to thank all of our speakers, and we now do have time for questions. We have a lot of time for questions, and I'm going to ask Stephanie to explain to all of you how to queue up for questions. And as we said earlier, certainly you can ask a question. However, as Dr. Palos had said, if you have a tip on how you do remember to take your pills on schedule or any of the issues that we discussed today, please do share that during the this period of time when you all can queue up. And so thank you. And Stephanie, could you explain to the audience how to do this?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Again, if you have a question at this time, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone.
And actually, as we're waiting for some of our voice questions to come on, we have some questions from some of our online participants. And so one of the questions actually has to do with the role of the caregiver in terms of assisting with all the different reminders about pill taking. And I wondered if Dr. Palos would address that.
Certainly. Caregivers have such an essential role whenever any patient is going through this type of journey or experience, or the marathon, like Dr. Morrow said. Caregivers are a second pair of eyes, they're a second pair of ears, and they're the reminder also to the patient about when those medications need to be taken or to even take them, to encourage them to take them. So I don't want to say the caregiver is a nag, because it doesn't. I don't want it to sound like that, but the caregiver, like I said, is an essential part of the care team. So I would really encourage patients to take their caregiver with them when they go on these visits, or someone, it can be a family member, it can be someone from their church or local organization, but someone who can be there to help listen and be that second pair of ears and second pair of eyes. It's very challenging for us when we visit the physician's office just for normal routine things. But when we know we're going to be given
some news with, regarding our medications or regarding our progress, it becomes even more fearful for us. So it's hard for us to remember everything that's being told to us. So the caregiver is essential in this team. The one thing I would caution is caregivers can also have their own symptoms of burden and get burned out. So they need to also maintain a balance when they're trying to provide that support to the patient.
Excellent, excellent point. And another question from one of our online participants is actually having to do with the side effects of treatment. And sometimes those side effects can be difficult in terms of thinking of stopping the medicines. And I wonder if Dr. Morrow could comment on this a bit.
So I yes, of course. So I alluded to the fact that, you know, that each drug has unique side effects. And there are, it's likely that each patient will have some effect of therapy, whether it's quite obvious and something that they have a daily reminder of, or sometimes they don't even notice until they make the, you know, they start therapy or if they stop for some reason. The common side effects, for example, of Gleevec include muscle cramps and bone pain, gastrointestinal side effects, fluid retention. Those are intense side effects, but of course they could change your daily routine and change your quality of life. And again, those need to be addressed and optimized and looked into. And nilotinib, one of our second-generation drugs, brings in the potential for a little bit more dermatologic side effects with rash, sometimes some changes in hair, some thinning. The lab tests that doctors check for a patient on nilotinib broaden a bit. We check things like pancreatic enzymes and EKGs. Dasatinib brings in the potential for internal fluid retention rather than external fluid retention, things that the physician would be looking for in exam, and the patient would need to know to report side effects like cough or shortness of breath for internal fluid accumulations. Again, all these side effects are very manageable. They're often not the reason for patients to stop therapy, but we certainly have to, A, be aware of what to look for, B, bring them up in the office, or bring them up to others so others can bring them up in the office or can call or ask. But sometimes it's hard, as we're hearing, you know, to have the entire scenario laid out and managed in a short office visit. So we need some help, and we need a team. It can take a village. It takes a village for me to manage sometimes, and it can take a village from the other side as well. So we all have to work together. So know about the common side effects. Know when to raise the issue. And talk about it early, talk about it often, so it doesn't become an impediment to long-term successful treatment.
Thank you. And another question that has come up, and it's actually for Dr. Thompson, is the online question had to do with insurance override, that they had not heard of that before, and if you could even, you've addressed it, but if you could say a little bit more about that, because this was not... It's really not actually such common knowledge. Everyone doesn't really know about that. So if you could share a bit more about that, that would be helpful.
Sure, yes. I know sometimes it seems like what goes on behind that counter is a complete mystery, whatever they're doing back there sometimes. So I'm happy to shed some more light on this. Certain insurance so as you guys all know, your insurance company restricts you to, you can get so many pills within so many days, and then you have to wait so long before you can refill that prescription again. One thing that the vacation override can be helpful for is if, you know, you will be gone and you say, you know what, that's great, then I can pick up more pills in 2 weeks, but I'm leaving, you know, in 1 week and I won't be back for 2 weeks after that. So that doesn't really help me a lot. And so one thing the pharmacist can then do on your behalf is contact your insurance provider, usually by phone, and it helps if it's within normal business hours. So it may take a day or two for the pharmacist to complete this. But they can contact the insurance provider and explain the situation, and then the insurance provider will offer them a one-time override, so you can pay your normal copay and pick up the medicine early, and then get back on your normal schedule after your trip is concluded and everything. One other thing to remember about this may also be helpful if you lose your medication or if it becomes damaged. You know, like we talked about, it can maybe melt in the car. Something like that does happen. You can ask your pharmacist to contact the insurance company and explain, you know, the medicine's damaged, they can't take it, or it's been stolen or lost. And sometimes insurance companies will also offer a one-time override for those types of situations as well, usually only one per year, though, in that case.
Well, thank you. This is something that is not really well known, and now everyone on the call knows this, so this is incredibly incredibly helpful. Let me ask the other issue that one of our online participants has asked us about, and that is actually remembering to take the pills, that because these are pills that are taken on a regular basis and over a long period of time, people seem to reply that they can forget to take them. And I wonder if, Dr. Palos, if you could start that discussion, but I'm going to ask everyone to comment on that, because that is often very daunting for people. And so, Dr. Palos, would you like to start? Even though we've addressed it a bit, if you want to say a bit more about it.
Of course. This is a wonderful opportunity for the whole family to get involved. For example, I was working with a family whose parents were having a difficult time maintaining the schedule. And part of it was because they were both in their 70s, and it was just hard for them to keep up with all the different medications and to keep up with all the side effects. So the family as a group sat down and got some poster boards, got all kinds of different color Sharpies and colors, and they all together made a poster with all the medications. They color-coded the medications, and they put in large font there, or large handwriting, because it wasn't on the computer, but large handwriting, when that was supposed to be taken. And they would put, like, the sun if it was going to be during the day, or they would put, like, the moon if it was going to be taken before they went to bed, and other little symbols like that. They were quite creative. So that was a very visual type of method that this family seemed to really appreciate, and it really helped, because we had the patient coming back saying, you know, I don't have this as much as I used to, or this is now resolved, I don't need to worry about that. So that's a very simple way to address this, and it's a nice way to get the whole family. We even had the grandchildren with that, so it was a wonderful way to get everyone involved in helping to take care of the patient.
Thank you. That's really wonderful. That's a wonderful story for everyone to carry around and remember. That's excellent. And Dr. Morrow, do you want to comment on this?
I enjoyed that as well. I guess I'm thinking use whatever tool is necessary, because I hear from a lot of my patients that I'm really glad to hear them say that if it wasn't for the fact that there was a pill bottle on the table or somewhere, that they might forget they had leukemia. And that's not a phrase where my colleagues are able to hear that often. And we're so happy that that's the case for CML, and we want to make it that way for many conditions, where if it wasn't for the medications, there would be very little side effects and no cues that the condition is there. The comment I would add is, if something happens and you get off schedule, don't panic. I get often a frantic call about, I don't know if I've taken my dose, I might have missed a dose, what do I do? Do I double up? Generally, a good conservative approach is to just pause. You know, of course, call in and find out if there's something different you ought to do, but it's probably generally safer to pick up and resume your normal schedule when it's due, rather than to try to double up and catch up for something that might have been missed, because it might be more side effects or problems involved. But whatever, each person has to find their own system that helps them work, whether it's some sort of external cue or reminder, localization, the things that we just mentioned, and obviously get others involved so they can remind.
Excellent, thank you. And that's an excellent example too, that if it weren't for the pill, the person wouldn't have to think about this. That's really what you're saying. We've reached that point now, which is such a different. Excellent. Dr. Thompson, do you want to comment about also just reminders that you can think of for people that just really help them?
Sure. One thing I would recommend, especially, you know, if you're helping to care for someone that has this disease that's not in your household where you're not able to remind them in person every day, is be aware of the technology that's available. I mean, there have been a lot of advances in even things such as simple as pill boxes. There are some now that are connected to an alarm that will go off to remind the person when it's time to take their medicine if they do need to do that. And so just, you know, if you're not able to be there and to provide that in-person support, we would all love to provide sometimes, there are also some options and other ways to help your loved one manage their disease and remember their medicines, just using some of the new technology features that are out there. A quick search on, like, Amazon or Google will bring up a lot of different companies that provide these types of products and a lot of different but with a lot of different bells and whistles, from the very simple organizers to ones that do have alarms and have, you know, some even can do verbal reminders now to tell you, you know, hey, take your medicine. So it's amazing how far we've come with those and how they'll continue to develop those and improve those.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank all of our speakers. You've really been an outstanding group and really have covered this topic so very well, and really you've all done marathon presentations on really a marathon topic, actually, and we hope that people have many tips that you've all offered them. I also want to thank all of you who've actually sent us your questions online electronically, and so that we could represent some of your concerns and questions as well. And I do want to remind you that this is a one-hour education workshop, and that in planning a program like this, we recognize that you have many needs that go far beyond the scope of one-hour program. And with that in mind, I do want to reiterate all the services that you can access from Cancer Care, as Rick had done just a few minutes ago, that you really want you to be aware that you can contact us at Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE, so we're simply a telephone call away. And we have a staff of 45 master's-level trained oncology social workers who are here to provide a host of services to you, from practical and financial assistance to counseling, which means having a skilled person to talk to about your concerns. And we also have a host of different types of support groups, both on the telephone and online. And those can be very helpful to people, and actually they don't require any travel on your part and allow you to participate with others, you know, coping with CML. And in addition to that, we also offer lots of education workshops like this one, and we have fact sheets and booklets that you can get from us as well. So we have lots of different things that you can get from Cancer Care, and I suggest that you will pick and choose the things that you feel that you need. But we are definitely here to help you. As we conclude the program today, I would not want anyone to feel that you're alone in your coping with CML. I want you to know that you're part of a community of support and that Cancer Care is here to help you, and we are simply a phone call away. And you can call us at 1-800-813-HOPE or visit our website at www.cancercare.org. I thank you all for participating, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.